Good afternoon. It is On the Money. We are talking money this afternoon, the good, the bad and the ugly of money, given that we are expecting another, I think the 11th in a row, interest rate rise tomorrow. In a moment, what we could take out of this that might actually be a good thing. Could you use these financially challenging times to try and find some financial literacy education for your kids or even for yourself? A man who needs that more than anybody I've ever met in my entire life is shareholder activist Stephen Mayne, who is my co-host in the next couple of hours, although after what I've just said, perhaps you're throwing me away. Hello, Stephen.
That's it. I'm off. I'm not talking to you.
You've had enough?
I'm well, Lindy. How are you?
I'm very good, but I'm finding it hard to hear you. Oh, that's a bit better. Yeah, it's the stock market's just changed. Closed today. Winners, losers, quickly.
It's been a bizarre day. It was up 150 points in the morning, and it's finished only up 19 points. So it's a real yo-yo.
Isn't it a day, though, the day before there's an announcement about interest rate rises, isn't it usually pretty quiet, where everyone just sits on their hands and waits to see what happens tomorrow? Has there been hand-sitting today or not?
Well, I think everyone was excited about this, you know, Chinese joining the takeover battle for Rio Tinto and the big resources boom continuing forever. And then the whole financial woe worries came in the afternoon, some losses in Asia, and so we lost like 60, 65 points in the last hour alone.
What do you think that is?
I think that there's jitters out there that, you know, Australia's got $600 billion of foreign debt, we've all borrowed too much, and there's financial strain, and the boom can't continue going on like it has. And I think, yes, the resources boom is going to save us, but then, you know, more news comes out about financial woes and too much debt and credit crisis, and that then causes a few more wobbles.
I played a bit of comedy earlier this afternoon that you may have heard, where they basically were talking about how, subprime crises occur because someone's sitting in a room and suddenly goes, I'm afraid. And, I mean, it is almost like that. It's interesting that something that seems as cold and as clinical as managing money and dealing with the stock market is actually a highly emotive, dramatic event sort of thing.
Well, I think the psychological trends of markets are absolutely fascinating. And there are absolute herd mentalities everywhere. And the herds are currently going down, and that's why we've seen markets fall by almost 20% globally. And I guess the funny thing about this credit crisis is that the smartest blokes in the room, all these Wall Street wonders, the dills who lent all these Americans who didn't have the money tens of billions of dollars or hundreds of billions of dollars, and they've now lost $300 or $400 billion, and it's caused a global shakedown. Well, that's sort of the bottom line of what's actually happened here.
We're actually hopeful a little later this afternoon to check in with China and check in with the UK just to see how they're going at the moment and what the impact may be, because in the end it has ended up being we're in this position because of what's going on internationally. But something like, was it 750,000 families are facing mortgage woes at the moment? It's just an inconceivable number of people, and it has to have a shakedown effect on the Australian society, quite apart from the financial aspect of the society.
Well, that's right. I mean, the total mortgage debt in Australia is now pushing $850 billion. It's up 320% since 1996. So we've all got record levels of debt, and we've got to service that debt. And, it's $1 trillion of household debt. It's just unsustainable. And that basically is the chickens coming home to roost, is we've all borrowed too much, we've all bought that plasma we can't afford, and riding on the back of the boom and doing it on borrowed money.
So the last thing we need then from what you're saying is an interest rate rise tomorrow.
I think the Reserve Bank have got rocks in their head if they put up interest rates tomorrow. I mean, we've already got a lot of stress and strain out there in mortgage belt land. And the Americans are at 3%. We don't need to go to 7% when the Americans are at 3% and the Europeans are at 4%. But I think Kevin Rudd and Wayne Swan are really hoping that the Reserve Bank does do it, so they can then go, that was the last guy. That was John Howard.
It's all his fault.
That was the inflation legacy.
They have been very, very careful today to stipulate that how the financial independence and the political independence that the Reserve Bank has, quite apart from the government. So we'll see what the decision is tomorrow. What I was saying before, though, is that is this an opportunity for us to use these financially challenging times to do something for good instead of evil, if you like, and try and encourage not just our kids but ourselves to work out how to be financially literate, I think is the term, or actually financially sound, to actually look after our money a little better. You were saying before that we've just exploded in our spending. It's become, it was a spree And yet perhaps if we'd been a bit smarter, we may not have found ourselves in this position. And to that end, the Smith family actually has a financial literacy program manager, believe it or not. He's sitting right between us right now. His name is Gregory Mole. Hello, Greg. Nice to meet you and have
you
come in here today. What do you do?
Well, look, I think for the very first thing is not to panic. So there's going to be some families over the next few months. If interest rates do rise tomorrow, it's going to put further strain on the household budget. And as Stephen was talking about just a minute before about the rise in household debt, now it's not so much the rise in mortgage debt, which is a concern to people like myself, it's a rise in credit card debt, because credit card debt is mostly used to fund consumer goods. So these are items which don't appreciate in value. For most people that borrowed for a mortgage over the last 10 years, you know, most people, their house would have appreciated in value over the last 10 years. So, I mean, if worse comes to worse, they can always sell the house to get out of debt. They've got a further problem of finding another place to live. But it's credit card debt, which is currently at $42 billion of credit card debt. And when I first started to do media reports like this, say about 7 or 8 years ago, the figure was at about $20 billion. And even then, people were going, $20 billion, but now it's at $42 billion. And what that means is that there is a lot of debt out there which has been used to help people mask the problems of their cash flow. So their expenses exceed their income. And there's a really simple example which I always use to illustrate the dangers of a credit card. That is, if you think of a person who suddenly receives their car rego bill, their electricity bill, a phone bill, and say their annual insurance bill, and those bills total $1,000. Now that person has not planned for those bills, they haven't put any savings aside, they haven't been prepaying them at all, so they don't have the money to pay the $1,000 worth of bills. However, that person has just been able to access a credit card with a limit of $1,000. Yes. So they use the credit card to pay the bills, and the next month they will be asked to pay a minimum monthly payment, which could be as low as $25. Now, most people will look me in the eyes and say, you know, we don't have a financial problem because we are paying our bills on time. I go, no, you haven't paid your bills at all. You've just parked them over here. You're being charged interest. And paying the minimum monthly payment doesn't touch the principal debt. So the Smith family has delivers financial literacy courses throughout Australia. And it's really for people that are not so much in here looking at the stock prices going up, because these are people that can only dream of owning shares and, you know, can only dream of fact, you know, having the honour of being worried about seeing the prices go down. These are people that are more concerned about the prices on the petrol bowser ticking over and going up.
Although you raise an issue about why that might be happening, and Stephen was talking about it as well too, that mentality at the moment that the more stuff you have, the better off you are and the more people admire you.
Mm.
But there's also the aspect that if, say, you're a 20-year-old, when I was 20, I didn't have any debt.
Mm.
I bought a car for $699. It was $700, but I only had $699, and I went to them. I paid cash,
yes,
because that's what I could scrape together.
That's right.
I didn't have a credit card. I didn't
have
a mobile phone.
That's right.
And the list goes on. Whereas now, you can have a credit card at 18. You can have a mobile phone at 16.
That's right.
And that can be going up and up and up, and perhaps you're using the credit card to pay that off. And so by the time you actually reach a stage where you're starting to buy some of the bigger items, bigger ticket items in life, you've already got a history and already a debt that's hanging over you.
That's right. And certainly today's youth are far more comfortable with having debt, because if they're going to university, they're leaving with a hex debt, you know, depending on what they're studying, could be up to $100,000. But following the trends in the USA, they're now being targeted while they're at the university, while they don't have a job, of being offered their first credit card to, say, a $500 balance. So they're more likely to keep on upping that credit card over the course of their studies, and, of course, when they finish their studies and go on to work. You know, Stephen mentioned before about the massive amounts of credit which Australians have been using, but you've got to appreciate that, in fact, you know, someone was offering those people credit. And most creditors, you know, the standards for checking the borrower's capacity to pay back that debt over the last 20 years, you know, I'm not saying they've fallen, but they've been sped up quite a bit. So, you know, 20 years ago, I used to be a loans officer, and I used to spend an hour just doing a simple loan application for someone borrowing $1,000.
Yes.
Now it's almost instant approval.
Now, Greg, we have one of the most profitable and valuable banking sectors in the world. The financial services sector constitutes about 40% of our stock market. Our big four banks are worth $250 billion. They're obviously making a lot of money out of these credit cards and everyone borrowing up to their eyeballs. What's the solution here? Are you in the let's regulate, let's stop the banks from throwing credit cards at all of us off the back of a truck?
No, look, it comes back. I mean, of course, I'm going to be saying about financial literacy, because if you were to ask me, you know, what is financial literacy? And a lot of people think it's all about teaching people how to budget, or at the other end of the spectrum, they think it's all about wealth creation, it's all about investments. But in fact, it does incorporate some of that. But the actual definition of financial literacy is it's the ability of people to make effective decisions and informed judgments about the use and management of money. So maybe to answer your point, you know, which is that those interest-free deals, you know, people go down to the big retail store to buy the big consumer item, which is going to be worthless in like 12 months' time, and they use it, they get a credit facility. If they pay the minimum payment, you know, in 5 years' time, they'll probably still owe about half of what they originally borrowed. Now, after going through our course, the people will learn, well, look, that's actually not a very wise decision to make, to use credit to buy something which is going to fall in value. You know, there are other purposes which you can be using credit for. It's about goal setting, it's about planning. So, you know, that credit is not a wise choice. However, if the person goes through our course, you know, knows all that, if they know all that, Stephen, but they still choose to get the $2,000 loan to buy the big screen TV, then that's their choice. You know, we can't stop them. You know, people have to be left to make their own decisions. So, in terms of regulating, you know, banks about the about distributing credit, I mean, that's been tried before in Australia. Different states around Australia, there's different legislation, Mike. There's different legislation around, for example, interest rate caps. You know, Queensland doesn't have one. You know, New South Wales and Victoria does. You know, what it's shown over the last 10 years is that, you know, people have a great capacity to use credit to fund their lifestyle.
I'm really curious to hear if there's anyone who's listening to us right now who's been through your course or indeed something like that and what they came out with at the end, because, I mean, you're in the business of saying that they work because otherwise you wouldn't be sitting here.
Yes.
But I'm wondering if there is somebody who can actually ring us and say that what they've achieved from doing a course like that and how that helped them further down the track. And is it something that stays with you, or is it, can you get you out of a bind over a 12-month period, and then you find yourself in another hole, and then you've got to, oh, that's right, I've got to reincorporate what I learned that last time. So
yeah.
Tell us the story. 1300 222 774 is the number. 1300 222 774. At 4:19, Lindy Burns with you. I'm in the foyer of the Stock Exchange building, a very, very gloomy foyer at the moment, with the storm clouds, what they look like, storm clouds, over the top of us, looking outside of the three-storey glass that surrounds us. With me, Stephen Mayne, shareholder activist, who is my co-host until 6 this evening. And our special guest is Greg Knoll, who's the Financial Literacy Program Manager with the Smith Family. So good to have you along. Be a part of the conversation. 1300 222 774. Can kids learn this stuff? And if so, do they keep hold of it?
Yes, and you know, that's something which the Smith Family is moving into. So to date, our financial literacy programs have been aimed at adults. So we have a financial literacy course. We also deliver a matched savings program aimed at adults. And I know that the Prime Minister announced a new savings plan. But you know, we help deliver a matched savings program where adults receive $1 for every dollar that they save towards their children's education cost over the course of the year. And what that program demonstrated is that adults who said that they weren't savers before they joined the program, 95% of them do reach their savings goal, and those match funds are delivered through the ANZ Bank. So financial literacy training is part of that savings program as well. So 95% of adults achieve their savings goal. That's with a dollar-for-dollar incentive.
Is it worth then?
Oh, I think it's a good initiative. I just want to know from Greg how I can stop my 6-year-old, 4-year-old, 3-year-old saying gimme, gimme, gimme every time we leave the house.
Yeah, and of course, you know, people know that, you know, children model their habits on their parents. But you know, something which the Smith family is working on is that, you know, it's going to take a long time for this culture, you know, this debt culture to be reversed, to get back to the savings culture which we once had. And of course, we're not saying debt is bad. We're not saying all debt is bad. But as I was talking about before about credit card debt, you know, dangerous debt, you know, borrowing money to fund consumption, to help fund your lifestyle. It's about, you know, changing that and making savings a social norm. And in many cases, it's not a case of the parents being good role models for the children, showing them how to be savers or how to be prudent with their finances. It has to be the reverse. You know, we are going to be targeting youth so they can be role models, actually shame their parents to say, hey dad, why is it that you keep spending all their money? Hey dad, why is it you keep whipping out that credit card? So it's actually like a reverse role modeling situation going on here.
Yeah, I don't know if that's going to work for you, Stephen.
I think it might struggle. I look at my parents and I look at the, you know, war rations in the UK. Now that created a culture of not spending money. You almost need a shock in the
yes,
society.
Well, perhaps this is what we're heading into now.
Maybe we've got it now, yeah.
Maybe that's the case. If that is the case, we'll be back to you on a regular basis, Greg, by the sounds of it. Thanks for coming in.
No worries.
Nice to see you today. Greg Moll, who's the Financial Literacy Program Manager with the Smith Family. No calls as yet from those who've been through something similar, but if you have, and I'd like to know, if both Stephen and I would like to know, has it worked for you, something like that. Have you been somewhere and been taught how to deal with money? Is it easy to learn that? 1300 222 774. 1300 222 774. Look, there are a few showers and possible thunderstorms, is what the Bureau is saying, Stephen. A few showers lurking about. We've been heading for a top of 25 today. It feels like about 900 sitting in the foyer at the moment, so I'm not sure if we reached that top. We probably did. Things that are making news. Research has found that smokers are aware of health risks, and a survey has found that young smokers know that cigarettes might kill them, and yet they continue to do so. Does that surprise you?
Well, no, not really, but we do have the lowest smoking rate in the world. So compared to our debt problems,
perhaps that's not such a big issue. Okay. And South Australian vineyard owner is suing a nursery for allegedly selling him thousands of the wrong grape vines. Yeah, that'd be pretty annoying. You're saying that you're putting out a Chardonnay, perhaps they've given you some Semillon. There's a traffic alert for you as well. Lights are out on the Princess Highway, the corner of Warrigal Road. If you've got some details on that, please call through 1300 222 774. 1300 222 774. Lindy Byrne, Stephen Mayne. We're in the foyer of the Stock Exchange building, Collins Street. Bernard Salt joining us very, very soon, and a man who's got a big job in his hands. We'll find out what that is in just a sec. I can't believe that it could be football season in just a couple of weeks. Hard to believe. Stephen Mayne, you and I were looking out the window thinking, gee, a bit of rain won't go astray. Our garden needs it. But we've been joined by a man who'll be just as happy, if not happier.
Indeed. The man sitting next to us here, Lindy, is Mr. Gordon Davis, the Managing Director of AWB Limited. Gordon, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Stephen. Good afternoon, Lindy.
Hi, Gordon. Nice to meet you.
Now, we haven't got Gordon in to talk about the weather, although we'd all love to see a good, solid deluge. But as a shareholder activist, Lindy, I have to say I am really quite excited by what should be a fascinating AWB annual meeting next Tuesday down there at Melbourne Park. Because after the whole battles of the single desk and the whole Iraq bribe scandal, Gordon Davis, the man sitting next to us, and the board have put up a proposal to remove farmer control over the AWB, to basically move to a more conventional structure. And Gordon's got a heck of a fight in his hands.
Does he ever?
It's not going to be easy. So, Gordon, how goes the battle?
Well, I don't see it as a battle. It's a part of an evolution from where we were to where we want to be. The board structure and the constitution was put in place by the government in the late 1990s when they privatised the old wheat board. And while the company was discharging a statutory function, it may have had some relevance, but going forward in a deregulated environment, it just doesn't have any relevance. So I don't see it more as a battle, more as a natural evolution from where we were.
Now, I remember Jeff Kennett once saying that no group of politicians will ever vote themselves voluntarily out of office. So my question for you, Gordon, is, will your 18,000 farmer shareholders really all put their hand up and say, yeah, we'll surrender board control, we'll hand over to the Collins Street Pinstripe Brigade?
I doubt whether we'll see 18,000 hands up, but of course we don't need that. We need 75% of those who bother to vote. And traditionally, votes of this nature attract only a relatively small participation. So one of our objectives is obviously to educate people as to why it's a good reason to go forward, but also to encourage them to participate. And trying to, so we've been conducting meetings to try and encourage growers to think about their future. The basic reason, I think, for them to focus on the future is it's in their interest that AWB is there as a, in a deregulated market as a viable competitive exporter. And I don't think they want any of the Australian companies to go into a what is a vigorous market with one hand tied behind their back.
In your mind, is that the only way that that the AWB can be viable into the future?
It's the wheat exporting is only one part of our business, of course, but it's the part around which the company was formed, so it's the part around which the constitution is framed. Since over the years, the company has diversified into a range of other activities. In fact, last year, export wheat marketing was only about 10% of our earnings, yet it still frames the whole constitution, shapes the board. So the business has moved on anyway, regardless of wheat marketing.
Now, the single desk is dead. There's been a change of government, but I gather there'd be a few of your farmer shareholders who are still fighting yesterday's wars and see this as a whole proxy about somehow getting back the single desk. You've accepted that the single desk, it's all over and they're dreaming, if that's the plan?
I think the single desk is dead, but it hasn't quite been buried, and that's probably the last element of debate. The government has been clear on their intentions. We expect to see new legislation by the 30th of June. I think it is time to move on, both for the industry, and it's clearly time to move on for the company. So I think any uncertainty should be removed. The Minister has made a number of statements saying that that's his intention. And yes, look, I think when this debate first started, some people felt that perhaps they could resurrect the old arguments of the past. But really, whether there's a single desk or not has nothing to do with AWB. That's a question for the growers and the government.
Now, Lydia, I have to tell you that as a shareholder activist, you never see boards get rolled. It just doesn't happen.
Keep going on about that.
99% is the normal thing. The only company where regularly directors get voted out or things get rolled is good old AWB because of this this cute sort of anachronistic structure they've got. So what happens if you get rolled next week, Gordon? As I actually think you probably will. 75% is going to be tough. If your farmer shareholders tell you to get nicked on this one, what do you do?
Well, the proposition, whether it's good for the company, won't change. So I'd imagine we'd revisit the issue later in the year when there is more certainty, when there is black letter law, and I'd certainly be encouraging the board to come back with very similar propositions.
So you'll come back, have another go?
Too right.
Oh, see, Stephen, that's right up your alley. It's what you continually do. Gordon, I'm wondering how the job has been for you, given that you've taken on what would seem to me as an outsider in all of this, as one of the more unenviable roles in corporate Australia over the last year or so. When you ring up somebody and go, oh, you know, hi, I'm the CEO of the AWB, do people actually hang up on you or do they take you seriously? What sort of reaction do you get?
I think people are very polite.
Initially.
I don't get that reaction. But look, I think there's a general recognition that there's a new management team trying to, you know, conducting reform on the company in a range of areas in cost, in people, in culture. And, a key element to that is this constitutional reform. So I think maybe they're not being polite, maybe they're just slightly respectful, but I don't get any adverse reaction.
I think when Gordon retires as CEO of AWB, he might go off and become a director of James Hardie. How about that? You like these tough challenges?
I think we'll just try and get through our own agenda first.
Yes, I'll be curious to see how that all pans out. Stephen, are you going?
Oh, we'll be there with bells on. Don't miss an AWB meeting. Should be fantastic.
Only you can speak of it in those sorts of terms. Gordon, good luck with it, I think. Although I've probably got 1,000 farmers ringing me right now and going, how dare you say that? Get our point of view as well.
I'll just be out of the foyer now.
Yes, indeed. Just do what you can out there. Lovely to have you in here. Gordon Davis, the CEO of the Australian Wheat Board, and a tough job on his hands to get the farmers out of the picture. Very interesting. Stephen, which way are you voting? Can I ask you that?
Well, I only get a vote on the first resolution. The second resolution is where the farmers have control.
Right.
So my vote will be irrelevant, but I will be voting in favour
of
good corporate governance.
Oh, that's good. In a moment, we'll be asking you a very important question that's come through on the SMS. What does a shareholder activist actually do? So while you're making up a response to that, with me, Stephen Mayne. And Stephen, it would have to be the quietest stock exchange that I've seen in quite some time. Why are they all running out and sort of rushing to the bar, as I expect stockbrokers to do on a regular basis?
Well, to be really honest with you, Lindy, there's an interesting story about this stock exchange in Melbourne. The stock exchange used to be based at 351 Collins when they had the floor. I remember starting out as a journalist back in January 1989, and it was a buzz of activity. Then they used to be across the road at 530 Collins, where they actually had the sort of the much bigger area, which was completely set up for people to watch the shares. And then the ASX, I guess, has gone on a bit of a cost-cutting drive, and they've moved across the road here, and now I guess the total ASX in Melbourne now constitutes that sort of screen on the wall over there with a few share prices.
Are you saying that the majority of floors above me have nothing whatsoever to do with the stock market?
The Grollo family built this thing back in the early 1980s, I think, and it's one of the biggest buildings in Melbourne, and 30 people in there work for the ASX. And if they had a few hundred more, I guess maybe the 626 stockbrokers who originally owned the ASX wouldn't have made 200 times on their money, because the great irony of the ASX is that the best investment you could have made on the ASX
was
in
the
shares in the ASX, because it is, have been an absolutely incredibly lucrative monopoly, which charges quite a fair bit for its product. It doesn't have huge numbers of staff in anywhere but Sydney. So it's very much a Sydney-centric stock exchange, and hence we have a very small presence for the ASX here at the Rialto.
But we've got a large presence here this afternoon, sitting in the foyer, probably the biggest thing they've had on this stage for quite some time, since the Christmas tree in December, I've been told. It's getting darker and darker outside, and we're curious to know whether or not there are some storms around the city, if you'd like to tell us about that. Use that number as always, 1300 222 774, 1300 222 774. And Stephen, I'm sure that you thought you were going to avoid the question that was texted a little earlier by Amelia. What does a shareholder activist actually do?
Well, I've bought shares in 620 Australian companies, and I've got the world's biggest small share portfolio, not even worth a couple of hundred grand, but so I have tiny shareholdings in all these companies, and I try to go to 50 AGMs a year and argue the case for better corporate governance, transparency and accountability. So hence our last guest, Gordon Davis, is fighting the brave fight to clean up the act at the AWB and get the farmers off the board, the farmers who were all asleep while $300 million was slipped to Saddam.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you're just basically, you're an activist, like a greenie argues for better environmental outcomes, a shareholder activist argues for better corporate governance and transparency in the public company sector.
And as a person, a friend of mine asked me at a dinner on Friday night, does Steve actually like what he does?
Oh, look, I actually, it's very sad, my wife thinks I'm crazy, but I actually get a lot of joy out of shareholder activism. Going to an AGM, having a good debate with Rupert Murdoch or, you know, the late Terry Packer, nothing better than that.
Yeah, you miss Kerry, I know you do.
Oh, dearly.
Now, the question a lot of people are asking is, what will happen tomorrow? Will interest rates go up for the 11th time in a row? Mm-hmm. I think it's the sixth time in 2 years. And then, more importantly, what effect will that have on Australia as a community, as a society? And so who better to have in to try and look into that crystal ball than Bernard Salt, demographer and, of course, the author of The Big Shift. Hi, Bernard. Nice to see you.
Hi, Lindy.
Are you a betting man? What are you putting on for tomorrow? What do you think will happen?
Well, I suppose the advice is that, yes, it will increase.
Despite the fact Stephen thinks it's a disgrace.
Disgrace or not, I think that it probably will increase. That seems to be the consensus view from all the experts in this field.
Lots of discussion about mortgage stress as a result of it. Not that we don't have mortgage stress now, we do. It's probably just going to expand to a greater selection of society. What do you think constitutes mortgage stress? What is the manifestation of that? And I'll give you a couple of examples, because people tend to think mortgage stress means you just lose your house. You have to sell your house. You can't simply afford to keep it anymore. But, I mean, when does it start? Maybe you can't go on a holiday for that year. Maybe you can't afford private health insurance anymore. Maybe you have to buy secondhand clothes for your kids. That sort of, I mean, what would you say was an evident aspect of mortgage stress?
Well, I think when you can actually see a material shift in the spending of middle Australia, for example, we've had 10 interest rate increases over the last 2 or 3 years or whatever it was, but that was still not sufficient to dampen the enthusiasm of consumer spending at Christmas time. So there was a lot of concern at each one of those increases in interest rates, but we still had enough money to spend record amounts at the sales and at Christmas time. I think that mortgage stress really will have an impact where we start to see people making real sacrifices and where we shift our values. At the moment, our values are such that we value consumerism, me-ism, hedonism, whereas we have let go of the old ideal of sacrifice. When we start to value notions like sacrifice, that, I think, will signal a real shift in Australian values. the frugal generation, that generation, that parents of the baby boomers, that generation that touched the Great Depression, that fought in the war, that experienced war rationing, if you ask them what quality they valued, they would talk about sacrifice. If you ask an Australian today what they think of the term sacrifice, they think, well, you're an idiot. Mm. You don't sacrifice, you consume. It's all about me. And people who make sacrifices are seen as losers, if you like. So there's been a 180-degree shift, I think, in attitudes towards consumerism over the last 50 years. And until I actually see a shift in consumerism, the valuing of greed, if you like, then I don't think that we will have true mortgage stress impacting middle Australia.
Now, it's a very difficult genie to put back in the bottle, though, Bernard, isn't it?
What's that?
To try and tackle rampant consumerism, which is a feature of our economy.
Absolutely. There is no doubt that the wealth of Australia today is based on consumerism. I'm simply making the observation that it is a very different Australia now to the Australia of, say, 30, 40, 50 years ago. Our wealth is based on, or predicated on, consumerism. We value it. I don't see any aspect of society valuing notions of self-sacrifice that we saw, say, 30, 40 years ago.
So in the end, it will take some sort of tipping point. There'll have to be something, either whether it's enough people within Australia will be under mortgage stress, whatever that might be, or there will be some massive shift in our thinking about what constitutes sacrifice. What do you see as being the tipping point?
Well, I actually don't think that middle Australia will revert to the values of, say, 50 years ago or a generation ago. But there may well be a section of the community, a subsection of the community, that does value that. That's, I suppose, the signal that we're actually starting to shift. If you have a look at something like Kath and Kim, if you have a look at that television program and look at the suburban house, nothing is sacrificed. They've got the plasma television. That is a very well-to-do consumerist household, and that represents middle Australia. When you start to see images like that shift, where people actually start to do without, go without, then I think we'll see that there has been a shift in attitudes towards consumerism by perhaps one stratum of society.
You're only ever going to see this come from the top, though, aren't you? I mean, one of my personal criticisms of the Howard government was that there was never any rhetoric about the community tightening their belt and saving. Whereas, you know, the Hawke and Keating years, it was always, you know, we've got to tighten our belt, we've got to save. So the Howard government was big on the government is saving, the government is in surplus. But they never got up there and said, as a community, we should be saving more. And I think we are seeing a subtle change now with the Rudd government identifying saving as something that needs to be encouraged. And a few subtle things like what Kevin Rudd is doing on homelessness, just to try and change the debate a little bit, which is what you would expect from the left party of politics.
Well, certainly that's true. On the one hand, we're getting $31 billion of tax cuts. On the other hand, we're looking for $3 or $4 billion in savings through some sort of a razor gang. So you do see this moderating influence coming through at the moment. And you're quite right about the last 10 years, the Howard years. It was all about consumerism. And it was very effective in catapulting Australia into a very well-to-do consumerist society over the last 10 years. The question is, can that continue? And probably cannot continue on that trajectory ad infinitum. There comes a point where we must recalibrate.
Bernard Salt is with Stephen Mayne and myself, Lindy Burns. We're sitting in the Stock Exchange foyer this afternoon. The markets have closed, of course, as they do at 4 o'clock, and we'll find out exactly what's happened when we're joined by Simon Power, who's going to come in the flesh, Stephen, and talk to us about that. Firstly, though, to Jo, who's in Gisborne. Hi, Jo.
Hello. I've just been at swimming with my kids in Gisborne, and we've had torrential downpour, thunder, lightning, and hailstones, just huge hailstones. So it's pretty horrible conditions out here.
Now, Gisborne, you can pretty much see a long way ahead and around you from that vantage point, Jo. How far do you think those storms are stretching?
They're going through from Wood End through, I can at least see down through to Sunbury. So they're definitely heading towards the city as far as I can see.
Right, so we can kind of feel that here. It has some sort of portent associated with it. So it's on its way. We've been warned. Thank you, Jo. You're safe in Emco now?
Yes, we're on our way back home. Hopefully the house isn't too wet. So.
Okay, I hope so too. Thank you. Bye-bye. Nothing wrong with the rain, but we'd like to be forewarned. So there we are, Gisborne through to Woodend, Sunbury. Storm's on their way, boys.
There is an atmosphere of impending gloom here at the stock market. The weather and all sorts of things.
There is. It sort of has that sense to it, doesn't
it? That's right.
At any moment it's going to hit us.
Yeah, when God or the weather god is sort of on our side as well at the same time. People are considering, Bernard, changing careers, if some of the reports I was reading in the paper today are any indication, and I'm sure they are. I mean, papers say the truth all the time, as we know. But they're actually thinking of changing their careers from whether they may be in a part-time job or a job that has an element of volunteerism associated with it, where they are thinking, OK, if I can't sell my house or scale back the mortgage or whatever it is, I'm going to just have to simply make more money. So that's another approach that we're seeing from people. How do you see that's going to pan out at a societal level?
Well, I think, again, this is a major shift that we're seeing, partly because of the low unemployment rate at the moment. People are feeling confident in the job market. If you don't like your job, then you can toss it in and try something else. We're very, very positive at the moment. There is also the argument that society is dominated at the moment by middle-aged baby boomers who have really made their money and who might be reassessing. You know, you might be in your early 50s, friend of a friend drops dead from a heart attack. You just all of a sudden reassess your priorities, and making as much money as you possibly can suddenly doesn't have the appeal, the cachet, that it did, say, when you were 31 or 32. And you might be interested in quality of life or concepts like volunteering or mentoring or coaching. It's all about organising your work around your life, run your life around your work. I think we're seeing that shift. Downshifting, sea change, tree change are all linked, I think, to that reassessment of life's priorities.
And yet, though, you're saying that those who may be then reassessing that, so the reassessing of the reassessment, are they perhaps not doing it because they are in what's really the enviable position now, where they own their house, so things like an interest rate rise tomorrow won't make much of a difference?
Well, I think that's right for people, say, 50 plus. But it's the impact, of course, is going to be most severe on people, Generation X's, in their 30s and early 40s, those people that are perhaps on one income, those people that have kids at home, that have mortgaged themselves to the hilt, of course. That's the slice of society. But the point is that that doesn't represent middle Australia. That represents a stratum, if you like. Australia's made up of a number of different demographic groups, some of which will be more significantly impacted by tomorrow's announcement than others.
Now, Bernard, I've heard you give a speech before where you've talked about the coming shock for baby boomers who are in their 50s who've been living like kings for, post-war period, and all of a sudden they're going to retire and they haven't got enough. They cannot sustain their expensive lifestyles, their children who now need support to get into the mortgage market. How is that generation going to cope with having to scale down their consumption?
Well, there's a number of ways you can do that. You can either downshift, sell your house in middle Melbourne and buy a cheaper property somewhere else and live off the difference. You'd sell that as a lifestyle shift. I'm doing a bit of a tree change or a sea change or whatever. Or you can extend your working life. But this is not working 60 hours a week through your 50s and 60s. This is working 5 days, 4 days, 3 days, 2 days, 1 day per week. And again, you'd put a positive spin around this. This is me organising my work around my life. I'm making the choice. And especially if the workplace is encouraging you to be a bit of a mentor, a bit of a coach, that sort of elder statesman type role. Also, baby boomers are looking at ways to weasel their way onto advisory boards and into non-executive directorships. I would expect to see company boards explode over the next 10, 15 years as baby boomers look for ways to weasel their way into a way of continuing their lifestyle.
But there's
their
a
60s.
Massive oversupply of wannabe directors out there.
Absolutely.
There's not enough board seats.
Well, we'll
for all the wannabe directors.
They will create them.
Creating it for themselves.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's classic. Bernard Salt, demographer, author of The Big Shift, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Great to have you with us this afternoon. With me as well, Sue Main, of course, shareholder activist. A couple of quick calls. I think Margaret's with me. I think she's on the Tullamarine or she's in Tullamarine. Margaret, are you there?
I'm just here. You might drop out any minute, Lindsay. We're just wanting people to put the last very glowing on.
wait, it's not working, Margaret. Put lights on is what I heard. It's very dark on the freeway. I think that's pretty much what we got. Is that right? Yes, we're thinking that's what it was. Gee, I hope she's all right. The storms are out there.
Down
I wonder where Bernard's going now. Now, you be careful out there, okay? Look after yourself. Brian's from Mansfield. Hello, Brian.
Oh, hello, Lindy. How are you? My two favourite commentators there, and you're so cool, Lindy. I just listening to you talking about the status of big lifestyles and this sort of thing, it always makes me wonder that the best marketing brains in Australia and globally seem to be hell-bent on making us believe that the big is somehow more successful, you know. And yet, if the status of the whole could shift to our thinking more along the lines that small is beautiful, if, you know, without sounding too wanky, it would have a huge effect. And I did hear in France, I'm a builder, and I did hear in France that some of the McMansion suburbs outside of Lyon are actually losing value because they're now considered quite naff.
Oh, that's interesting. So they're not cool anymore. They're not the thing that's desirable. Good on you, Brian. Thank you for that. I'll just get a quick comment from Bernard about whether that's a possibility for here.
I'm not convinced about that. I haven't seen any evidence yet of Australians pulling back from rampant consumerism. I'd like to say that I do, and certainly events, say, tomorrow might lead to a shift in thinking. But we seem to be pushing head first into a particular direction, which is more consumerism, and unfortunately, I think that's the short-term outlook.
Okay, thanks again.
Pleasure.
We'll let you go really truly this time. Bernard Salt, thank you so much. It's just on 9:25. Lindy Burns and Stephen Mayne, we are in the foyer, the ever-darkening foyer that is in front of the Australian Stock Exchange here in Collins Street. The five people who are still working upstairs who are too frightened to come downstairs and go out the front because we think we might point and laugh at them. It is getting dark out there. If you have some information for us about the storms, don't let Margaret put you off because we still do want to hear. As long as you can do it safely, call us on 1300 222 774. That would be terrific. Now, Stephen, sitting next to you is a man I've never met before. I speak to him every day, once a fortnight. Does that make sense? For 5 days every fortnight. Simon Power, of course, is from Holt Stockbrokers, and we check out what's going on in the market each day. Hello, Simon.
Hi, Lindy.
It's nice to meet you in the flesh.
Likewise.
Have you met Stephen before is the question?
No.
Has shaken hands?
Have you? That's all right. He hasn't harassed you in any way or rung you up or chairs off you?
No, not yet.
Not
so.
Yet? So perhaps you can set up some sort of a deal there.
Where have you come from?
Where's
your offices? Are they
they're not in this building.
Just a block away, so we're in Bourke Street, the old BHP building.
I think it's a pertinent day to ask this question. What do you do? What does a stockbroker do these days? Is that what you do?
I sit in front of a computer on the phone most of the day. So, for example, today I probably spoke to 15, 20 clients, and a number of them were just buying and selling. Some were just wanting reassurance, advice. A few people I'd met this week, we'd put together a portfolio for them. For investments, and some of that we began buying today, and we'll progressively do that. So a lot of it is, yes, just speaking to clients most of the day.
Now, I used to speak to my equivalent of you every day as well, but now
every
I simply log on to the internet and do it all myself. Have you found that a lot of your older clients are now doing it themselves and don't need you?
There's certainly been a big change in the industry in the last 5 to 10 years, so we haven't noticed a huge shift. It's more some of the smaller clients, the more active trading ones who do want to get cheaper brokerage and quick online access. The bulk of our client base tends to be a lot more long-term focused and building portfolios, and they tend to appreciate the advice and often don't have the time themselves to log on and do all the research and trade and everything themselves. But it certainly had a big impact on the industry.
Have you ever been in a situation where you've actually been on the floor of an exchange sort of shouting and throwing little bits of shredded paper in the air? No.
No, unfortunately that doesn't exist anymore apart from a few of the sort of commodities exchanges over in the US and elsewhere. So yeah, a few of the senior advisors spend a lot of time doing that, and they tell some funny stories of their days on the floor. But yes, we're unfortunately in front of computer screens. It's not as romantic.
As it once was, which was probably the reason you got into it in the first place. Look, but we need to quickly check in with Geoffrey Connigan, who's at Melbourne Airport. Geoffrey, are you there?
Oh, hello, Lindy. Good afternoon. The status, you're phoning about the status of the airport.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. There's a big storm has just hit Melbourne Airport. there's electrical activity up there, so the aprons have been cleared of staff because of the danger of lightning on water on the apron because of the storm. So both runways are currently closed. Nothing is taking off, and we're not receiving anything either. But while that sounds very dramatic, these storms, electrical storms, pass quickly. It's not the water that's the problem, it's the electricity. So electric storms generally pass in 15 minutes, and then things get back to normal.
So how long do you think the runway will be closed? Once the storm has passed, it's okay? You can reopen straight away?
Yeah. As soon as the electrical activity ceases, the fellows out on the apron work in all sorts of conditions, but obviously not lightning because of the safety issue. Unfortunately, as you know, it's 5 minutes to five, so it's the busy period for business travellers coming in and going out. So it will cause some disruptions. For 774 listeners, if they can log on to the Melbourne Airport website, we have live flight information.
Okay, that's right.
We'll give them the status of their flight, so they'll know basically what sort of delays there've been.
Okay, that's great. And so if you've got a flight tonight, maybe that's the best thing for you to do, rather than ring the airport, as people tend to do. Jeffrey, okay, thank you for that. We'll stay in touch.
Okay, I've just read past a note that landings have recommenced, but there's no departures at this stage.
So it must
be passing already.
Yeah, that's good news indeed. Jeffrey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, right, there you go, Stephen. It's happening right now. In fact, we can hear the thunder out here.
We can.
And it's looking a little darker, which is a bit disturbing. We need to go to the weather quickly, if that's all right with you, Simon. I don't know if we'll get a chance to talk to you in a moment. Stick around with us, if you don't mind, after 5 o'clock. Terry Ryan's at the Bureau. Hello, Terry.
Lindy, how's things?
Things are all right, but where are those storms? Obviously at the airport.
Yeah, we can see them on the radar. We have warnings out for those. There are other ones out in west and south Gippsland and to the north of us if you check our website and the radars there. But a lot of the Melbourne area is fine right now. There's no rain, but up towards the airport the visibility is down about 5,000 metres and there are thunderstorms nearby. So the risk of a thunderstorm for most of the metropolitan area this evening, just the odd shower or two about. Very humid today and we've got to 33 degrees. I thought we might struggle to make 28 with the cloud that I thought would develop, but it took ages to develop. And 33 degrees eventually, but down to 19 tonight, 25 tomorrow. So some showers tomorrow around, chance of a storm about the outer eastern suburbs, but those storms should move away on Wednesday as a southerly comes in. A few showers though just Wednesday, 14 to 24, and some rain in Gippsland. It looks like a decent low pressure system developing off the New South Wales south coast, bringing rain into Gippsland for Tuesday, Wednesday, so a good rain event there. But a few showers in Melbourne again on Thursday, 14 to 21, just a shower to Friday, 13 to 19, and then fine for Saturday, Sunday, Monday, 22, 24, 25. So where's our summer gone to, you might say? With no real warmth there as far as warm days go, but quite humid days initially, but they'll dry out again by the weekend and not very hot.
No, not too bad. I think 25 is still okay. I'm happy with that. Terry, thank you so very much, and good to hear that the storms aren't going to be too bad, but quite a bit of activity, rain activity in Gippsland as well. I don't know if it's the last thing that they might need. Stephen Mayne is with me. He's my co-host. Coming up after the news at 5 o'clock, we'll be chatting with Saul Esling, economist with the ANZ. Simon didn't get a chance to give his report, so I think we need to do that.
Simon's got to do it. Brief summary now, then stick around till later.
Yeah, I think you can hang around. So we'll make sure that we do that because, after all, we are in the stock exchange for you. The last thing we want to do is
market
do the market
bump
report
on stock exchange day. I mean, how do you feel, Simon? It's a big storm. That's what I'll tell you. It was a big storm,
yeah,
Simon. We had to bump you.
Yeah. Thanks, Stephen.
He's staying. He gets to stay back.
That's
right. He gets a special favour from the stock exchange.
So do you as well. That's all right. Russell Howcroft will be along. I wonder how the current financial situation is affecting the advertising industry. Hopefully badly.
Well, they're the ones who tell us what to spend. I blame them.
Okay, let's get stuck into Russell after 5:30. We'll have a look at a bit of soccer as well as a big game on Wednesday night at the MCG. Stephen Mayne, Lindy Burns with you after the news. Welcome to the foyer of the Stock Exchange. Lots of glass around me and, of course, the market closing around an hour and 12 minutes ago. Simon Power, you have pride of place to give your report today, sort of just before the news. Thanks for being with us once again. Now, how has the market ended up today?
Another very interesting
market's very strong early in the morning, up 175 points, but then late afternoon selling, particularly in the banks. The market closed only 39 points higher, 5,922. Some concerns that Moody's may downgrade about $75 billion worth of mortgage-backed bonds that are linked to a US insurer that they've got some concerns over, and that's about 45% of Australia's mortgage bond market, so some real concerns there. Commonwealth, the worst hit, down $2.12 to $49. National Bank also down $1.21, $34.19. Resources, it was a different story, both strong there. BHP up 77 to $39.32. They report their results on Wednesday. Also, the deadline for them to increase their offer or put a formal offer on the table for Rio Tinto. And news out of London over on Friday there that China, Alco and Alcoa had taken 12% of Rio Tinto PLC, so that's thrown a bit of a cat amongst the pigeons there. They're up 80 cents to $128. Also in the news was Fortescue, further confirmation that Chinese are interested in buying up our resource assets. Rumours that a couple of their companies were wanting to take a 15% stake. Fortescue confirmed they'd been in informal discussions, so they're up 10% today to $7.18. Telstra down 3 at $4.38. Wesfarmers, one of the better performers, up $1.60 at $39. Commodities market, Cindy, gold was a little weaker at $909. The oil price also slipped down to $89. And the Aussie dollar, quite strong, also ahead of the interest rate decision tomorrow, expectations that the RBA may raise rates. $90, $90.50 against the US, just over 46 pence, 61.08 for the euro, and just under 97 against the Japanese yen.
Okay, you've done very well, Simon. Thank you for coming down. And Stephen's taken some notes, so he'll be making...
I have to say that with Fortescue up 10%, we're back in the territory of Andrew Forrest is Australia's richest man.
There you go.
Again. So he's up over $7 billion, which you can argue is maybe more than Rupert Murdoch and James Packer. So, 10% surge in Fortescue changes daily at the top almost of the rich list.
It does indeed, and he'll be smiling yet again. Thanks, Simon.
Pleasure,
Simon
indeed.
Power from Holt Stockbrokers joining us in the foyer of the Australian Stock Exchange. A very smiling man over there. Hello. Thank you for coming down and saying hello. It is interesting to see how likely it seems that interest rates will go up tomorrow, despite the majority of commentators, including yourself, Stephen, saying that this shouldn't in fact happen. Many are asking why they should go up. Why don't we wait until we see the fallout of the US recession, if I can call it that? People are still a bit scared to call it that. And my other question is, why is a 3% inflation figure seemingly sacrosanct here in Australia? And with me, my co-host on this day of money, at 774, Stephen Mayne. Stephen, thanks for hanging around.
Pleasure.
And the ANZ economist, Saul Lesak. Hello, Saul.
Hello, Lydie.
Nice to see you. Firstly, why do you think we need an interest rate rise tomorrow? Do you think we do?
Well, I think the key question is, does the Reserve Bank think we need one? My job.
What they're going to think.
Well, my job, I suppose, as an economist for a bank is to say what they will do so that hopefully our customers will be prepared for it, rather than necessarily preach to them or anybody else about what they should. I'll leave that to some of the other commentators. But the Reserve Bank's job is to keep inflation at between 2 and 3% on average over the course of the business cycle. Incidentally, that does mean, unlike some other central banks around the world, that if you have a quarter or two where it's above 3 or below 2, the Reserve Bank doesn't necessarily have to take drastic action in either direction. Our inflation target is officially described as a flexible exchange rate target, so that they do have some latitude to take account of other factors, including growth and unemployment, that are important to society as a whole. But the problem confronting the Reserve Bank is that underlying inflation is running at its highest level, no matter how you measure it, since 1991, well above the 2 to 3% target band, and according to the Reserve Bank as well as the Treasury, predicted to remain above that target band for all of this year 2008. And for the Reserve Bank to sit idly when confronted with those figures and with that prospect would potentially undermine its credibility in the ongoing battle against inflation and leave open the risk that inflation continues to accelerate, so that by the time the Reserve Bank recognised, if it didn't do anything now, that inflation had got out of control, we'd be talking about more than a quarter of a percentage point hike in interest rates in order to bring it back down to acceptable levels again.
Although Stephen doesn't agree with you. He doesn't think that there needs to be an interest rate rise tomorrow.
Well, Stephen, I mean, our currency is already pushing 90 cents. That's hurting a lot of exporters. The Europeans are at 4%, the Americans are at 3%. I can't see why we need to go to 7%. And the argument I'll put to you, Saul, is aren't there other ways of tackling inflation, like fiscal policy, maybe having a look at those crazily irresponsible tax cuts which are coming in next June, wages policy, industrial relations policy. I mean, that will be a very big test for the Rudd government in terms of all these wage claims you'll see from their union friends. And they're doing a few things like having a supermarkets inquiry. I mean, there's been super profits for the supermarket duopoly, so they're having a bit of a look there. I'd argue with Saul here that, you know, the bank, the big banks and all their charges going up, maybe you could have a bit of a policy to put a bit of pressure on Saul's bank fees. Surely there are some other things you can do, Saul, rather than just using the blunt instrument of interest rates going up yet again.
Well, there's nothing else the Reserve Bank can do, and that's the institution we're talking about at the moment, other than change the official cash rate. I have somewhat lonely, I must say, spent most of the last 4 years arguing that fiscal policy should have been doing something to dampen inflationary pressures. I've argued that one of the reasons why the 10 hikes in interest rates that we've had since 2002 haven't had the dampening impact on spending and inflation that the textbooks and historical experience tells us that they should have had is because those hikes in interest rates have been repeatedly offset, or indeed more than offset, by repeated rounds of income tax cuts, and those tax cuts have put money into the pockets of just about everyone who has a job, whereas the higher interest rates have hurt, and they have hurt significantly in some cases, the minority of Australian households who have a mortgage.
Couldn't agree more.
What is it, Saul, about 3%? When did we get to that figure? What's the historical reason for why inflation should be kept below 3% in this country?
That's a figure that emerged out of the 1991 recession that Paul Keating so famously said that we had to have, that in the aftermath of that, the Reserve Bank under Bernie Fraser decided almost unilaterally that having a target of between 2 and 3% on average over the course of the business cycle was an appropriate balance between the desirable objective of keeping inflation low, especially since the decline in inflation was bought at such a high cost in the recession of the early 1990s, and not being so dogmatic about keeping low inflation that you run an unacceptable cost in terms of unemployment or growth in order to get there. And it's perhaps worth making the point that Australia's inflation target is actually a little looser or more flexible than the inflation targets of many other central banks. For example, in New Zealand, for a long time, the inflation target was 0 to 2 without any let-outs. It's now expressed as 1 to 3. The inflation target of the European Central Bank is below 2 without any let-outs. And the Federal Reserve, although it doesn't have a formal inflation target, informally targets 2% as its preferred comfort zone for inflation as well. So Australia is actually being less dogmatic about targeting inflation than many of the other countries with which we normally compare ourselves.
But look at the Americans. They've just gone 1.25 percentage cut in their official interest rates over an 8-day period down to 3%, which is now, I think, below their inflation rate, isn't it? So they've actually got their official interest rate below their inflation rate, and our official interest rates are going to go to 7 when our inflation rate is 3 to 4, depending how you're measuring it. So why can't we be like the Americans?
Because, well, certainly I'd rather be in our situation than theirs, where the Americans are cutting interest rates in vastly different economic circumstances from the ones that we confront. In particular, as reported by the Stats Bureau today, Australian house prices have risen by 12.3% over the past year, whereas in America they've fallen by 8.8%. Australia's unemployment rate is 4.4% and either falling or steady. America's is 5% and rising. America is on the cusp of recession. Nobody is suggesting that Australia's economy is in imminent danger of falling into recession. And Australia benefits from rising commodity prices and the rapid growth and industrialization of countries like China, whereas for the United States, many Americans feel that the rapid growth and industrialization of China is a threat to their economic growth rather than something that they benefit from.
Gentlemen, I'll just jump in there because one of the major stories of today, quite apart from the pending interest rate rise tomorrow, is the amount of storms that are around the state. In fact, in Gippsland, the Mount Tassie transmitter has gone off air. We're not sure what the reason is. We assume it's something to do with the storms that are there. Broadcast Australia currently working on it, and we will have regular storm updates right here on 774 for the rest of the afternoon. In fact, we'll have a full update on the storm damage and where those storms are from the SES at around 5:30. So that's the major concern for this afternoon with the storms in various parts of the state, including a major storm warning for Melbourne City. If you have some details, we'd like to hear from you. 1300 222 774 if there is a storm around your area. Use that number, 1300 222 774. With me in the foyer of the Stock Exchange, where I must admit there's a tiny bit of sun coming through, which is putting pay to all of my comments of the storm and the pending clouds of doom that are coming over us as a result of what's going to happen tomorrow. A bit of light coming through the glass there, as you were talking, Saul, which is interesting, to say the least. Fixed rates. So many people talking about going to fixed interest rates, which people tend to do it around this time. I can remember I went to that when we were heading around the 18% and I fixed at 15, and we promptly dropped about 2 years later to about 11, and I was left standing there with my 15%. I mean, that's the big thing that people have to take into consideration with fixed rates.
Well, that and the fact that if you do enter into a fixed rate contract, fixed means what it says, and that you can't change it if your circumstances change. If, for example, one member of the household ceases working for whatever reason and you want to lower your mortgage repayments, you can't. If you get a bonus or win Tats Lotto and you want to pay off a lump of the outstanding mortgage, you can't. If you decide to move and want to sell your house, repay the mortgage and take out another one in a different state, you can't with a fixed rate loan. So fixed rates are marvellous as a form of insurance if you take them out at the right time of the cycle, but they do restrict your flexibility, and so people who are contemplating that do need to have a fairly solid idea of where their finances are going over the next 3 or 4 years.
Okay, a timely end, I think, to this conversation. Or, Stephen, do you want him to hang around so he can get stuck into him after 5:30?
Oh, that'd be a bit of fun. I'll just ask one quick one. In one word, do we have a major problem with a debt addiction in Australia?
Some of us do. The majority of Australians, I think, who have debt are capable of servicing the debt which they have, and most of them have in turn put it to use in ways that have made them better off. But a significant minority of us have taken on too much debt, and the cost of that, we Australians, have taken on more debt than we can service at the kind of interest rates we're likely to experience, and that minority of Australians will be feeling some pain.
Look, I think the pair of you need to go out and throw your balance sheets at each other, and we'll just see how that pans out. Saul, thank you. I should have warned you that Stephen would be... No, I did. I did tell you that Stephen would be here. It's always good to get two sides of an argument. We'll see what happens tomorrow, but all intents and purposes, it is almost a fait accompli, but what the fallout will be remains to be seen. Thanks for coming down.
That's a pleasure.
Saul Eslake, the economist with the ANZ. Stephen Mayne is my co-host until 6 this evening. I wonder who else he'll fight with. We've always got Russell Howcroft coming up after 5:30. He is good sport, of course, the ad man that he is. 25 to 6, Stephen Mayne is with me as well. Good afternoon, particularly if you just joined us for the very first time. Some storm updates in the next 5 minutes, particularly what's going on in Gippsland, where the transmitter for the ABC, the Mount Tassie transmitter, has been affected, and we'll give you some updates on that as soon as we can. But Stephen, certainly the subprime crisis, hard to say that quickly, is rippling across the globe. Of course, started in America, we're feeling the effects here. We've got expected interest rate rise tomorrow, which is the main reason that we're here this afternoon. My question is how it's playing out in the UK. We're just talking with Bernard a little earlier, and with Saul. Bernard saying, hearing some reports that the way in which it's planning out in Europe is that we're starting to see a sort of a change in attitude towards the greed is good, the whole idea of materialism, which may be the best way to go about things. So with us is Nikki Clark, who is with the BBC Radio 5 live program, Wake Up to Money, and he's with us this afternoon. Nikki, hello.
Good evening, Lindy.
Good evening, and good morning and good night to you, by the sounds of it. It's probably about 5 a.m. or something, so thanks for taking our call. How are things playing out in the UK?
Well, I think the credit crunch has just started to bite. It's come through at the corporate level. Companies are finding that the money they want to borrow is no longer there, or if it's there, they're paying a lot more for it. You know, we've had a socialist government in charge now for the best part of 11 years. The then Chancellor gave the Bank of England independence to keep inflation under control. He talked of prudence, which everyone thought was one of his old girlfriends for a couple of years, but in fact what he was talking about was tight fiscal policy. And everything was cruising along. We had low inflation, cheap interest rates, and then a tidal wave of money came in. People were taking out mortgages that they couldn't afford. We had companies buying other companies, paying for cash with borrowed money. Everything was chugging along, and then the Americans decided to lend money to people who couldn't afford to pay it back. And that's when all the cracks started to appear, and the whole economy started to unravel at a fairly brisk rate.
Now, Mickey, it's Stephen Mayne here. Is it fair to say that the Northern Rock crisis, the first run on a British bank in more than 100 years, the British government having to lend them $120 billion, did that cause quite a cultural shift? I mean, it triggered quite a fall in your house prices as a start, didn't it? It was a real shock to the system, wasn't it?
It was indeed, and it's fair to say that there was that one particular weekend in the autumn when suddenly television viewers saw people queuing up round the block to get their money out of a bank, and they'd never experienced that before. And it's got to be said that Northern Rock wasn't as a result of the credit crunch. It wasn't that they'd lent money that wasn't being paid back. It was the fact that most of their funding came from the wholesale market. When the wholesale market dried up, they had no funding. The government had to go in and bail them out, although a lot of people in the city argued they should have been allowed to go bust.
I think that would have caused an even bigger crisis of confidence, though, wouldn't it, if they'd gone bust? I mean, the government had to step in. It's too big to fall, surely.
Well, the government stepped in because if it had been called Southern Rock, the cynics would say that perhaps the government wouldn't have stepped in. But these were Labour strongholds, and as a result of that, they did step in. And the argument they used was that, you know, it was to underpin the entire banking system. Well, if you look very closely, very few UK banks have actually written a great deal off as regard to the credit crunch. So either they're hiding something, or they've actually got away with it. But, I mean, we've seen $1 billion with Barclays, the odd billion with Royal Bank of Scotland, but nowhere near the scale of write-offs that we've seen in America.
How is the community in general responding to that? How is the UK economy? How are people spending money? We're spending money hand over fist here on pretty much everything that moves and doesn't move. Is that the same sort of thing for you?
No, I think it, to a certain extent it's drying up now. You know, retailers complained at Christmas, as they do every year, that things had tailed off. But certainly there does seem to be a certain amount of belt tightening going on. And it's just starting to get through to the consumer. And I think it was Northern Rock that probably did it. That, you know, hey-ho, things aren't that good with the economy at the moment.
But, Mickey, you've got the new status, I guess, London. People are now saying it's overtaken New York as the global financial centre. House prices in London highest in the world's most expensive city. You guys are, you know, above all this global pain, aren't you? London's the epicentre now. You can withstand this sort of pressure, can't you?
No. I mean, our house prices are unique compared with everywhere else in the world. This is a small island. More and more people want to own their own property, and so we're more interest rate sensitive. But, you know, the Americans, just as much as us, are relying on economies like China and India, you know, the new growth economies, and even they're showing signs of slowing down, in which case, you know, they've kept us going for some time. If they slow down, we slow down with them.
And speaking of losing trophy assets, what's the reaction to the Chinese Communist government writing out a cheque for $15.5 billion on a Friday night and buying 12% of your venerable Rio Tinto? Has that gone down all right?
I think it's going down all right. I think there are a number of European companies that are looking now at the sovereign states, as they call it, these countries that have banked the money for years and now really don't know what to do with it. So they're coming in and snapping out a lot of good deals, it's got to be said. The Rio Tinto deal the other night, I'm not sure if they thought that was a good idea. The Rio Tinto price did shoot up because someone was prepared to pay $60, but there are those in the market who say that Rio Tinto is now a sell because this has blocked any takeover that BHP might want to make.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, it's good to talk to you about this afternoon, Mickey, particularly when we've been concentrating on our own market, our own woes, and what might be the fallout of yet another interest rate rise for us tomorrow. And good to remember that we are all part of the international scene. Thanks for talking to us.
Pleasure.
Mickey Clark, who was a BBC Radio 5 live presenter on the program Wake Up to Money, which we've tried to do today, Stephen. I don't know if we've managed to put people to sleep or to wake them up. Sun is shining. I don't know what the storm is doing. It's kind of bizarre, really. I think we should check out with Tim Weebush, who is with the SES. He's the State Duty Officer. Hello, Tim. Tim, are you there?
Yes, I certainly am.
Oh, it's Lindy and Stephen. How are you?
Very well.
major concerns today? Where have been the storms and what sort of damage has occurred?
Look, this afternoon storm cells have developed out to the west of Melbourne, and in particular areas out across Sunbury and Gisborne have been hardest hit. Sunbury, in fact, have had nearly 40-odd jobs in the last hour where residents have reported flash flooding, leaking roofs and some tree damage as well.
How many calls?
Overall, we've only had around about 60, but those 60 have been in about the last hour, so we've been averaging around about 1 to 2 calls a minute for the last hour now.
So do you know whether that's pretty much it, or are you expecting that to continue if the storm cells are actually moving?
No, severe thunderstorms are likely to continue to produce damaging winds, very heavy rainfall, flash flooding and large hailstones over the metropolitan area in the next few hours, but also we've just had reports that storm cells are about to hit down around Mowi and also coming in across Geelong.
Right, so two very separate parts of the state, and on each side of us, just quietly, I hope they don't converge over the top of the Rialto in the next half hour. No, of course they're not going to do that. What should people do just to ready themselves, Tim?
Yes, look, this afternoon, Lindy, we're advising motorists to be particularly careful on the roads, particularly out to the west of Melbourne where there is the possibility of flash flooding on the roads. Also, debris that may have come down as a result of tree damage. But also, if residents across the rest of Melbourne are getting home tonight, to perhaps ensure they've got any loose items secured around their home, as the storm cells are likely to continue for the next 2 to 3 hours.
Okay, we've been warned and given some advice. Thanks, Tim. Thanks.
Good on you, Lenny.
Tim Weebush, who is a state duty officer with the SES. Take care. Particularly, it sort of seems a bit bizarre for us to be talking about this at the moment, Stephen, because about an hour ago it was much more threatening and the sun is shining.
The sun is out.
This is kind of strange. Just a reminder, though, in Gippsland, the Mount Tassie transmitter has gone off air. Broadcast Australia working on it at the moment. So as soon as we can bring you further details, we will do that and continue to bring you storm information as soon as it comes to hand.
I'm sure Macquarie Bank will fix up your transmitter issues very quickly.
Really? You think so?
Well, Macquarie Bank owns them.
Do they? Of course they do. I remember you telling me about that. Yes, well, this is a test. You can ring them up.
Tell the Millionaires Factory to get us back on the air.
Give them a hard time. 17 to 6, Lindy Burns and Stephen Mayne. We are in the now extremely sunny foyer of the Australian Stock Exchange building here in, it's not the building, it's the Rialto, it's in the foyer of that. In Collins Street, and a rather warm afternoon outside and some storms threatening, so please take care where you are. Before we chat with Russell Howcroft, who is my usual fortnightly guest on a Monday afternoon, you brought a book in. In fact, I reckon, Russell, you'll be interested in this book. Hello, by the way.
Hi, Lindy.
Russell Howcroft, of course, is the MD of George Patterson Y&R, Adman, as we like to call him. He wears kind of little funny ears when he comes in as well, which he's not doing today. So Stephen's brought a book that I reckon is going to cause a bit of an interesting debate in this country, or discussion anyway, and there's been a few elements of it that have been released the media.
It's gone on sale today. It's called Rupert's Adventures in China, How Murdoch Lost a Fortune and Found a Wife. Now, what's interesting about this is it's been written by the man who ran Rupert's China policy, or his China operation for most of the late 1990s, a guy called Bruce Dover. And he has just written chapter and verse on how he introduced Rupert to his third wife, Wendy Ding, but more importantly, how Rupert just absolutely grovelled and tried to work the Chinese authorities. He did deals with the Deng Xiaoping's children. He did deals with the next president's children. He just worked so hard to get in with the Chinese to open up their pay TV satellite market. And then they just stuffed him. They just said no, and they wouldn't let him do it. And so he's lost more than $1 billion in China. But the detail of how much sort of grovelling he did to the communist authorities, our great Rupert, the great sort of capitalist crusader. And for this book to come out literally on the day, the Chinese government had said, hey, we want to buy $15 billion worth of Rio Tinto shares, and we want your government to give us approval for that. I mean, one response from Rupert might be, well, why didn't you let our most famous entrepreneur into your satellite TV market if you want to come in and buy up all our mines?
Does Bruce have a theory on why the Chinese in the end said no?
Well, they just, Rupert's legendary record for changing governments and exerting power.
I'm
just like, we don't want this guy bringing Western culture and potentially advocating capitalism and democracy. He's a threat to us, and he's
going to come in and do what we're doing so well ourselves already.
That's right. We don't want someone who advocated going into Iraq and was George Bush's mate. Basically, Rupert's the great sort of
power broker of media moguls of history, and the Chinese just sort of said, look, you know, for all his grovelling to us, and it was just extraordinary the lengths that Rupert went to, they've eventually just said, sorry, Mr. Murdoch, see you later. That's an amazing tale, I have to say.
It is a good and the parts in it where he talks about how, as you say, he introduced him to Wendy Deng and the way that she was conducting herself, not badly, but the way the sorts of work that she was doing already in China and around other parts of the world. It's a real insight into what he just took for granted as another relationship, and he didn't realise why the two of them had come together in the first place. But that is a real insight into it. You'll be reading it, won't you, Russell?
I will be reading it. You know, I'm one of those people that goes to the airport, sees a book about someone like Rupert Murdoch and pick it up and use the plane trip to read it. You know, I mean, that's sort of, there's plenty of time spent on planes, so you get to read Packers Lunch, etc. They're always good reads.
I want to know a couple of questions. Will it be available in China? And will it be reported in the Murdoch press? I suspect no and no is my guess.
Well, you'll be able to track it, Stephen.
Now I think about it, the excerpts were in Fairfax.
Yes.
If you have a question for Russell, the first question you want to ask is a little bit about Rio.
Yeah, if you were the advertising sort of marketing advisor to the Chinese government and you've just bought...
Which he is, by the way.
Yeah, that's right, and you've just bought...
Someone would be.
You now own more of Australia than the Australian government does, which is what the Chinese government now does after Friday night's raid. And you want to do a pitch to basically say it's okay for the Chinese Communist Party to control the great trophy resource assets of the Pilbara, etc. How would you frame such a campaign to win the hearts and minds of Australians that this is a great idea?
Well, you're unlikely to advertise. You would certainly use public affairs, and you would probably talk about the long tradition of international investment in the Australian marketplace that's part of what makes us prosperous, I would imagine. So I don't know that you'd be spending money on creating advertising to put out your position.
He's good, isn't he?
Yeah, he is good, because I think that's right, that we're making a fortune out of China now, so we want to keep this party going. And if that means they snap up a few of our key assets, well, you know, as long as the mining boom goes on all because of China, then what's wrong with that?
Well, there's some quid pro quo there, I suppose. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, from an advertising perspective, there isn't a campaign. You may choose to influence shareholders via a full-page ad in the Financial Review, just as a general strategy that you'll see often in the market, where you will try to put forward your case. And this is where advertising, Stephen, is deeply honest, because
he had to get it in. What time is it?
No, yeah. But see, a piece of advertising has to say where it comes from. Whereas any editorial which is a point of view or an article which may have been spun, you don't know where it's come from. You may know the journalist, or you may know that you recognise the byline, or if you like, rely on the integrity of the banner, but you actually don't really know the position of media. You always know the position of advertising. It's entirely self-interested. So when you read it and you see where it comes from, you can read it with total objectivity.
Knowing that you're supposed to put the glasses on, those rosy glasses, before you start.
Knowing whose position is being put forward.
Yeah.
You know, political advertising, clearly a government is going to advertise itself as being fabulous, and, you know, that's just how it goes. But I, as I say, I think it is the honest end of the business because no one's trying to spin anything. It's when you get into the, if you like, corporate affairs area and public relations area and influence area that perhaps sometimes it gets greyer.
I reckon that the advertising industry is in a really interesting position at the moment, because you've got potentially the 11th straight interest rate rise tomorrow, the 6th in 2 years, people under mortgage stress. We've been talking about that all afternoon. But at the same time, as Bernard Salt was telling us, we're still in the middle of this consumerist society that we all want as much as we possibly can and be seen to be worthwhile because of that purchasing power. How does advertising and marketing work in such a climate?
Well, it's interesting. I remembered seeing Phil Riven from Ibis World. He gave a presentation a few years ago, and I managed to track down one of his charts, which I've got here in front of me. And it was interesting in that consumer spending has only ever fallen below 1% growth per annum twice in the last 40-odd years. In 1961, it fell below 1% growth. And in 1991, it fell below 1% growth. So it's very, very rare for consumers to not demand more year on year. In fact, it's incredibly rare for that to happen. And I was just remembering back to 1991. I can't remember the exact interest rate, but I'm sure Stephen would know. It was more like, what, 15 or something?
17.
So we are not even halfway there. I think money is still, you know, relatively cheaper than it was back in that period. We also know that media is forecast to grow this year. At a global level, it will grow. It will grow because of three It'll grow because of the Olympics. It'll grow because of the presidential election. It'll grow because of the European Cup finals. So there are three big global reasons for media to continue to spend. And in Australia, Mitchell's Communication, of course, your guest Harold, you know, they're predicting, I think, 7.4% growth in media this year. Even newspapers are predicted to grow, Stephen, only by 1%. But internet, which of course is the major growth engine for consumer marketing, is predicted to grow 36% this year.
God.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why marketers love it, and one of the reasons why us in advertising love it, is because it's far more you're far more able to target it. Therefore, there's less wastage. The people that are demanding a product, they'll use the internet. They go straight to it. So it's more of an accountable media. Which is why it's got 36% growth, of course.
But just going back to talking about it being accountable, one of the things that Stephen and I were talking about this afternoon is what role is there for marketing companies and advertising companies to play in trying to encourage us not to spend? I know that sounds bizarre, but let's just give you that idea for a while.
Well, is this some policy? Am I sort of not aware of a policy that says we should stop spending? I'm sure if there was a brief given to a advertising agency about we need to reduce spend, then an agency would find a way. Equally, the brief that you made...
The classic negative do less campaign is TAC. Drive slower, be more careful, slow down, and it's been a massive reduction in that whole economic activity.
That's right, Stephen. So, you know, the power of advertising to influence behaviour one way or the other.
Smoking. Yeah. Ban the smoking ads.
Absolutely.
And we've had the lowest rates in the world, so why should we ban other advertising?
No, but what I'm saying is that if there is a policy which says we need to reduce expenditure, then there's a brief which would come from the Reserve Bank or from someone in government, I would imagine, mm-hmm. and then an agency would set about achieving it. But I'm not aware of a brief that's out there that says, let's reduce expenditure. There is, of course, a strong desire for the advertising industry to use itself for good.
I'm actually speechless.
Reduction in road toll, reduction in smoking, these are things which the industry can do. We've discussed before, the industry is getting very engaged with the green movement, trying to increase sustainable practices just as an industry, but also to drive demand for sustainable practices. That's something which will get, I would imagine, some serious growth in the next couple of years, whereby we will be using our skills to influence different behaviour around sustainable practice.
Now, here's one for you, Russell. We've got an obesity epidemic in Australia. Mm. The Howard government, a number of people suggested they should ban fast food advertising on children's television. And I think I, for one, thought it was a great idea. The Howard philosophy was, it's up to the individual. You never tell the individual how to behave. The nanny state is not going to step in on that issue. For me, it sounds like a no-brainer. As an advertising guy, what would be wrong with banning fast food advertising with children's programs?
It's not so much about what's wrong. It's more about discovering all the reasons why we have growth in obesity and growth in... there may well be a better way to put it. There is more children that are more overweight than they used to be, and some children are obese. So it's not everyone is obese. And there is... I went to a seminar on this not that long ago, Stephen, and one of the reasons why children are more overweight than they have been in the past is that they don't walk to school. So advertising can be used to encourage people to walk to school. Another reason why is, according to an urban planner that I was listening to, is because the footpaths aren't wide enough and therefore they can't ride their bikes to school. So advertising can play a role in encouraging wider footpaths and people riding their bikes to school. So it's not just about saying, well, look, the advertising, they're playing a role in this. It's such a simplistic argument. Even if we look at the TAC, the TAC has had great success, advertising has played a role, but it's only played a little bit of a role. Equally, a role has been played by the police presence, by changing signage, by ensuring that you have got better roads. You know, there's an investment in the whole of how society operates in order to reduce the road toll.
Russell, you'll be pleased to know that Stephen can't ask you another question because we're out of time. But I'm going to let the pair of you go away and fight about that out in Collins Street. So if you're in the city and you'd like to come and see a fight between two of the higher profile people who live in Melbourne, in Stephen Mayne and Russell Herkoff, I've been wanting to get you two on together for such a long time.
I didn't even get onto debt and banks.
Well, I know.
Oh,
sorry.
Gee, we'll do that outside.
Can we do that as well in a couple of weeks' time?
Sure.
I think we might do that as well. Thank you so much, Russell. Lovely to have you here. Russell Herkoff. has joined me once again, and we'll be doing it fortnightly for this year. The MD, of course, George Patterson, Y and R. Derek Gill is back in the studio, primed and ready to go, Stephen, for tonight. Hello, Derek.
I'm in the wrong spot. I should be down there watching the fight.
You so should be.
You are the thinking.
You'd win.
You are the thinking person's Don King.
Not with this hair on.
Have you
not,
seen my hair lately?
Fair enough.
I just need a perm to create that look. Oh, that's beautiful. By the way, that other person is Brad, on his last day on air in this program, interestingly enough. Derek, this evening?
This evening, has your invitation arrived in the mail yet?
It depends what for.
To the big summit, the convention of 1,000 most intelligent
Australians.
Think tank.
I read that this morning and I went, I'm not going to get an invite to that, am I? It was the first thing that came to my head.
Why aren't you going to be
I just
invited?
Don't think they'll be inviting me.
I'm hoping. Well, that leaves me out too then, doesn't it, I suppose?
Yes, it does, Terry. It's true.
Aren't tall people intelligent? That's the problem.
I just don't think that we like to bother to get together at that sort of think tank. My hope is that there's going to be something constructive that comes out of it, but my jury's out on that.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing. And there's some interesting topics under discussion, and you wonder how far they can go in 2 days. But I'm hopeful that there'll be some sort of consensus about the sorts of vision for the sorts of future we want. I'm like many Australians, I think I'm sick of the short-term thinking from governments and oppositions who are looking to the next election, which is only 3 or 4 years away. I want to hear ideals and ideas for when my grandson is a grandfather.
Yeah, lovely. That's good. Ooh. And then, of course, you'll put all those together and send them off to the think tank, won't you?
Well, I should send Miles. That's it. I should give him a little list of things that he can think about and talk to them. Now that he's 17 months, he's very erudite. But anyway, so I want to know tonight who should be on this panel. Who do you reckon ought to make up some of the special 1,000, and what are your instant reactions to the sorts of areas that the Prime Minister is asking people to look into in terms of vision for the future and shaping our long-term strategy?
Yes, I was pleased and shocked to see the arts were there. What are they thinking? They're a federal government. They talk about arts.
Yeah, but housing prices weren't.
Look, Anthony from Analyzer rang in to tell me the Frankston Freeway very slow from Springvale Road until Thompson's due to resurfacing works and a lower speed limit. Frees up then as usual, slow stop start all the way through to Sky Road. Joanne from Lyndhurst said the Monash is very unpleasant from Warrigal Road to Jackson's Road and all the way to the Gippy Highway turnoff. And don't forget, outbound on the Prince's Freeway down there near Hoppers Crossing, Forsyth Road off-ramp will be closed in half an hour while they right a truck that has turned over.
Good on you. Thanks, guys. See you tonight, Derek, after 7. Stephen, you've been a champion. Thank you.
Thanks, Lenny. Great fun.
And we'll see you, cricket permitting, in about a month, by the sounds of it, over Lindy Burns at the Stock Exchange. Thanks for listening.